We appreciate it. We're going to continue to grow. It's all been organic and grassroots, and it's a real feel-good story. So we appreciate it. First and foremost, we cannot be here without you. We want to thank you guys for sure. We also want to thank our crew, everybody that we have working with us. Man, Sid takes care of everything. Larry, Mike, Pam. As I always say, you see me and Troy, but you know, there's all people behind us.
Yeah, it doesn't get done without them, so shout out to them.
So, all right, so today we have a very special guest today. We've talked about the music industry before, but today we're going to talk about the music industry. We're going to talk about a lot of different stuff, but we're going to start with that. So we have Derek Ferguson. So Derek, his resume is very long, so I'll try to get back.
Can I start with a quick story? We always talk about how we had a list of people we wanted to get on our show, and it's obviously week 21, but we're checking off names as we go, right? Like we obviously had Brandy on, and we had Derek on the top of this, because what we do is sports entertainment, and you embody that, and your story is amazing. So I just want we're gonna keep checking off names and add names, and people are giving us suggestions as we go. So keep sending us those, and we'll add them to our list, man. This is amazing.
Yeah. So he graduated from Wharton School of Business in 1985, actually. Brandon Copeland went to Wharton as well.
Yeah.
So if anybody's not familiar, Wharton's like the number one school, business school in the world, one of the top business schools in the world.
Yep.
And then he graduated from Harvard in 1990.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously stayed at the top of the realm as far as education. Then he went to go work for Sean Combs, right? At Bad Boy Enterprises, and had a lot of different jobs there, but with the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, if anybody's not familiar.
Yeah, don't let that go over your head.
CFO of Bad Boy Enterprises, then he was the Chief Growth Officer at Bad Boy, and then he transitioned to Revolt TV, where he was the COO of Revolt, and now he is involved with Robinhood. He's also involved with Capital Pre- A lot of stuff. But first and foremost, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Yeah,
thank you. Thank
well,
you.
I just got to say a few things. definitely thank you for having me. Humble to be here. And to talk about a topic that really I've been living in like 30 years. So it's kind of great that this podcast is really opening up a new set of conversations about what really is the backbone of what we're trying to do, right? What we're trying to achieve. I think we talk past the real issues a lot, and I've already loved what you have done on this podcast, because you're getting to the real truth. And we need to know the truth, because we need to know where we're starting to then know where we're going. So this is, I'm a fan. I listen to a number of podcasts, but I'll say what's been great about it for me is, one, the truth in it, but two, I've learned a lot. And I've been, appreciate it. The last thing I say is that, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about how you identify business opportunities, and we were talking about this earlier, but you truly have found the white space.
Yeah.
Off camera, we'll talk about a bunch of ideas around how do you keep driving that white space, because there's a lot to go and get filled in that white space.
We hear that slogan a lot.
Yeah. But, and, you know, just lastly, full disclosure, you know, Troy and I have known each other for a number of years, and, you know, I'm just proud of the entrepreneurship you're showing.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you guys thinking of something and just not keeping talking about it and just doing it.
Yeah.
And I see great things in the future.
If anybody's not familiar with white space, it's not an ethnic thing.
That's a good clarification.
Now, what the white space means is, like, you're the only one that's doing it, right? You're in the white hot space, and that's kind of, it's very rare in life when you can be the only ones in the world that's really doing something in the fashion that you're doing it, right? Yeah. So, humbly speaking, thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
And, I think that's one of our driving forces behind the success of the podcast, we deliver the message of financial literacy in a way where nobody else is really doing it like that, and, Once again, thank you, guys.
I'm going to add a new term that I want you to start really drilling. It's first financial literacy, got to have that.
Yeah.
But then financial discipline.
Okay.
let's jump right into it because you were, all right, so Bad Boy, right?
Yes.
CFO. If anybody's not familiar, as I said before, CFO, Chief Financial Officer. So you pretty much was the head honcho in Bad Boy, right? Because that financially, obviously, that's the most important thing in any business is the finances, and you were the head of finance. You were the head of finances, the financial decisions for Bad Boy Enterprise, right? So everybody knows that Diddy is a genius and an excellent businessman, right? But you were there, like you were the man.
You're the numbers guy.
Yeah, you're bigger than the numbers guy. You're the guy.
The guy.
So, all right, can we just talk from the top down as far as you've watched that whole organization grow from the bottom to the top? The financial structure of that. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind, I know we're on limited time, I just want to back up a little bit because I don't want people to hear my background and think, get the wrong thought that I'm like from a silver spoon or anything. I'm like a lot of you out there listening. I grew up in the Bronx, South Bronx, Soundview. Neither my mother or father went to college, so my oldest brother was, you know, we were the first generation of college goers in our family. But my parents always stressed education in the household, period. My father was an entrepreneur, his father was an entrepreneur, so the two things stressed in my household were entrepreneurship and education.
So as far as Bad Boy, right, can we just break this down? We'll start with the music, Ken. A lot of people aspire to be in the music business, right? But they don't fully understand the inner workings of the music business. So you was telling us before we started shooting, the difference between masters and publishing and all that stuff. Can you just have a conversation about that?
Sure. Okay, great. So the revenue streams and ownership streams in music is very important to understand. The master itself, so just think about the physical product. CD, if it's a CD, the digital product.
Those are discs that play inside of the audio player. For those not in the know, right?
Yes,
no way.
Never know what
a
CD is. The actual product itself is owned by the record label, right? So that master is owned by the record label in most cases, right? So now you hear a lot more stories about people owning their masters, and we'll get to that. But in most cases, if I'm a record label and I fund the entire project, I'm going to own those masters in perpetuity in most cases, right? The second part of the economic stream, which is one that isn't discussed as much but could be really lucrative, is the intellectual property that went onto the master. The intellectual property that went onto the master is the copyright, right? The copyright, that's the song and the production, right? So that song production is its own asset. Right? Record labels don't generally own the song, although Bad Boy at the time and a lot of kind of boutique labels had its own publishing company, right? So as a publisher, you can strike deals with writers and producers and own some of their publishing and share in the profits of their publishing. But in and of itself, unless you create another entity or you strike a different deal, you will own the master as a record label, but not necessarily own the copyright. The copyright is where a writer, a producer, and so on can create their own stream of money. What's really important about the copyright rate is that, one, it's a law basically. It's dictated by the law. So the copyright rate, back in the days when there was a thing called a unit, right, was like a cents per unit. I think now it's like 12 and a half cents or something. By now. So just to make it simple, we're selling singles, right? A million singles would generate a million times 13 cents, $130,000 in copyright income, right? That copyright income is actually paid by the record label to the copyright owners, right? And then the good news about the copyright income also is that 50% of the copyright is owned by the actual, is generally split out to the actual writers. So it's a way for a writer to have a direct stream of income is through that copyright.
So it's more of an incentive for people to write their own music rather than have somebody write it for you because you're not going to make as much money.
Absolutely. Another thing that, again, people miss, and a lot of people say, wow, these records sold 20 million albums and I didn't make much money, samples come in too. Samples can take up some of your master money and also can take up your copyright, depending on what you used and how it was structured. So, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but a sample where you actually play the record, right, where you actually sample, I put needle to the record, they say, that's going to eat into your master income. So I, you know, so I produced a song, and I put a needle on the record, and that ended up in the ultimate master. Then part of that royalty income that would be earned by that song, by that master, will need to be paid out to the sample.
It's like the kid Juice WRLD. You know him? Heard of him before?
Yes.
Yeah, so he had this song, his song Lucid Dreams, and I think 70% of the publishing went to Sting.
Yeah. Right.
Because it was interpolation,
right.
I think was the
right.
term,
right.
where they didn't
right.
use the whole sample, but they used enough of it.
Right.
Where it was enough to get him all the publishing.
Right. So the second part, just quickly, yeah. The sample side. Second part, regarding the copyright, if I just use the lyrics, let's just say I use the same lyrics. It's all about the Benjamin, baby, right? And I use that in another song, right? And but I didn't drop the needle, and it's not Diddy's voice. Then I still would have to carve out some of my copyright for the original lyric.
If you use the lyric. Because
I use those lyrics.
That happens.
We saw that with Robin Thicke.
Yeah.
He did that with the Blurred Lines, right? And then Marvin Gaye's family sued and won that lawsuit.
Yeah.
And now most recently, you said Juice WRLD, but Ariana Grande as well. Yeah. Seven Rings. Right? I think 90% of all proceeds went to, but is that Visa, the Feel of Love, that song?
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's interesting too, especially with the rap lyrics, because that happens all the time in rap.
Absolutely.
Like, even you talking about Diddy, I remember he's like broken glass everywhere. Like,
yeah,
he, that's from Curtis Blow.
But yeah, so that's just important to know because, well, nowadays, people are really savvy about it. Back in 98, 99, that's when the whole, you know, all the sample regulations were really just getting solidified, right? So there were a lot of mistakes made. But the worst thing you could do is put something out that has a sample in it and you haven't tried to clear it or anything and somebody then discovers it because then there's all kind of damages and so on that someone can claim from you using their work.
So De La Soul did that with Me, Myself, and I. That was their biggest song and they made no money from it because they sampled it and didn't even know.
So just my clarification because I didn't know this. If you use a line from somebody else's song, you have to pay them for that?
Yes. Assuming it's their original line.
Like I said, because that's common in rap.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
the time people do that. They take lines all the time.
Yeah. And you may have, like, again, depending on how long it is and so on, you may have some variations. Like, or you may have people that would say, you know, you can use that or whatever. You know, like, but yeah, generally, if I take your lyrics, that is intellectual property that you own.
So you guys got a lot of checks from Jay-Z then. Shout out to Jay.
I don't remember seeing those. Probably they probably you know,
if anybody
exchanges.
If anybody's too young to know what I'm talking about, Jay, you know, Jay
say a big verse.
He said a lot of big verses.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
If we look on No Way Out, if we look on some of Puff's albums, if we look at the writing credits, we might see Sean Puff's name as well.
Right.
So they might have worked out a deal.
Shout out to Jay-Z. I got this question before, and people, it's trendy to own your masters. Everybody wants to own their masters. Steve Stout has a company, United Masters, where he allows artists to own their masters. But, for somebody coming in the game, how do you own your masters? Like, how do you do it?
Right, so, okay, and this is why I'm so excited about this podcast. I'm going to talk to you about some real stuff that's really, I think, important for the future as we frame how we go forward as a community and talking about hip-hop as a hip-hop community and how do we want to control more of the wealth and value and also utilize that to impact our communities in a greater way. The biggest failure of hip-hop was that we did not act as a collective unit when hip-hop became big, right? So the greatest way to take power away from anything is to fragment it, right? So if I can fragment a community, if I can fragment anything, a fragment of country, you know, I'm going to take power away from it. So what happened was, my view is that if you, let's just think about it as you had this incredible raw material, you know, hip hop. Let's say it's, we would say it's indigenously just owned
like
by
vibranium.
Yeah, it's like vibranium. It's like almost like Black Panther. We look at that, it was a metaphor for it, right? But we didn't keep it under our control. So imagine we had the hip hop council and said, anything you want to do in hip hop, you gotta come through us. So so when you look at and if we did that, the values you could have started asking for because you control it, right? And this is the only place you could get it. As soon as it started fragmenting out, it's like, well, I can run over here and get this one and pay them $1 million and I can get it and get some of that. Well, I can split this one off and 10 million is going to sound like a lot, but I'm making billions and I can get it here. So fragmenting hip hop was something, you know, looking back, that as, you know, if you want to think about, we talk about own your value and been talking about the same stuff, honestly, for so long. And we have to say, we just botched it up. But we do have an opportunity, I think, going forward to fix it. We'll get to that. Also, one of the reasons I brought my son here, who's working on something right now that we'll talk about. But the bottom line is that, and at that time, why did we give up ownership and rights? See, at that time, the way music was distributed was really trucks and warehouses. Mm-hmm. So why do I need a label? I need a label to get product into the stores. I need a label to spend the money to promote the product. I need a label to spend the money to make the videos, right? I need a label to help market to the ultimate consumers, right? So that's why I go to label. Otherwise, I wouldn't need a label. All of those reasons why we used to have to go to labels are no longer necessary parts of the process.
I was going
to
say that I'm checking off. Like,
right.
Don't
checks and warehouses, don't care about that anymore. I can get directly to my consumer, right? So why do I need a label to help me get to my consumers? Why do I need video cost? You know, I'm from the days where we would spend over $1 million on a video. Video costs are nothing, right? So we have now gotten to a space where even if that was, you know, we shouldn't have made that decision anyway, but, you know, all of the factors that led us to making that decision to give up, really, we gave up what we call in the business schools of the world, we gave up so much of the value chain, right, that we gave up, you know, we gave up so many parts of the profit that we were left with a little piece. And only some people were left with a little piece. Yeah. And that's how we did it. So not only your masters, really ultimately, for the reasons of trucks and warehouses, all these things, and now when you say it, you're like, you gave me a master's because of trucks and warehouses? You know, like, but that's what we did. You know, means that now when you sit here right now, you look at, you know, the hip-hop music industry that created something from nothing, right? We are now, you know, moving back to a space where we have to figure out how do we go own what we basically mined, right, and created. So we got to go back and figure out how do we own what we created. How do we have a Black Panther? How do we have a Black Panther that does billions of dollars around the world? What? How much of that did the quote unquote hip hop community earn from that? That's all. They took everything. Every metaphor, every visual, everything in that movie was really a culmination. It's like, again, if I had the vibranium, if I mined some kind of ore, and then all of a sudden you made this incredible statue out of that ore, and you sold it for $15 billion, and I was like, but wait, didn't I create that ore? And isn't that mine? And I got, like, none of that? Yeah. That's what we're looking at right now. So the future, and where we're replicating that mistake, if I may, is with social media. We're replicating that mistake with social media and big data media, right? Big data media is saying to you and I, and all of us, and we're all falling into the trap, hey, this is all free for you. Put this stuff up on YouTube and put this on here, and it's all free for you. I'm such a nice, kind person. I'm giving you this free search. Google search is free. Come on in, search. Tell me everything about your lives. But what we're giving up is not free. What we're giving up is all of our data, which they've been going and parlaying into, again, billions of dollars of value, billions of dollars of income on our data. There's some stat which is about 30% of the activity on Twitter are from African Americans and minorities.
Yeah.
So that whole valuation of Twitter is driven by that activity, because all of that data is what's feeding advertisers, which feeding, you know, feeding all of their value in their proposition. So we have recreated, I think, this sacrificing value for somebody else in that space. Now, the good news. The good news is that the world is going to move away from big data. I mean, as we have this, if there's anything we can get out of this episode, just to know that what you think is free is not free. Google is not free to you. Facebook is not free to you. YouTube is not free to you, especially if you're creating dope content like this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, imagine a world, though, where we could get this content directly to your listeners without any go-between. That's where the world is going. The world is going to this phone and the text messaging space. Everything Facebook is investing in right now is regarding text, because I'm going to be able to create my own audiences and text directly to them. I don't need Google, Facebook, etc. If I have my audience created and I can reach them all directly via their phones, then I don't need to give up all that I'm giving up to these big data companies in order to reach my audience. I can reach them effectively. They don't have to give up their information to come get to hear this show, and I don't have to give up my viewers that I've created and built. Here's the biggest kicker about it's almost like it's the real kick in the face that a lot of people don't even get. So you guys have, I looked at it, incredible growth, 60,000 followers on Instagram. When you send out a picture or whatever, you're getting hit with the algorithm. So you may send out, like we may send out a picture of this podcast, and of your 60,000 followers, maybe 500 even get it, even see it. So you've taken time to build this audience that you can't even, that they will dictate how many of them you can reach. Versus imagine if you built this audience directly on text. I can't give away my whole, my son's whole business plan. But if we could, the bottom line is that we could cut out the middle people that are taking all the value and building this tremendous wealth and valuation and go direct, we can really create value and own value and own our own content.
All right, so now we're going to go into the next segment of business. But before we do, this is double back. So as far as ownership of masters, how can somebody own their masters?
How can somebody own their masters? One is you never give them up, right? So you create your own music and you just distribute it on your own, and you've never done a deal with somebody which says you own the masters. Master ownership is really about, at some point you had to give it up. You had to say to somebody, I'm going to take X, you know, thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, whatever, and you in turn take the ownership of my masters. So one is to never give it up, right? The second is, the only other way is to buy it back, right? So if you've given it up in the past, maybe the company doesn't value it as much as you do, you can then buy it back. But I would say the way to go forward is to not give it up.
You know, I never really thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense, because like I said, somebody DM'd me and they was like, well, how can I own my masters? Never sell it.
Never sell it.
I guess you own your masters.
Yeah. You own them right now.
Right now you own them.
Right.
Yeah. We saw some, Rihanna brought hers back, and I think Russell Wilson just brought Ciara's masters back. So yeah, don't give it up.
Yeah.
It's yours.
All right. Yeah, the thing is that we're giving, and think about what you're giving it up for. You may be giving it up for $10,000, $30,000, whatever the numbers are, right? And that's where, again, when we talk about what the missed opportunity was, if we had this community, right, that had now was building wealth, and we were like, hey, you know what? We're going to sow into our next generation of creatives and create a platform for them where they don't have to give up their masters, and they can thrive and shine and earn. You know, this is, you know, again, it's very much thinking about the greater good of the community, but we don't have that opportunity because these are public companies, you know, that own this, and they're trying to do what the right thing for their shareholders, which is to own these masters as long as they can own them and make money from them as long as they can.
Yeah, they're taking advantage of people who come from nothing. So like, if you dangle $2 million and I have nothing,
yeah,
$2 million seems like $2 billion.
Yes, and yeah. By the way, that is what Steve Stout is doing, and he's on our board at Robinhood, so
yeah,
that's been a great thing. We just added on the
commissioner, Steve Stout.
Shout out to Steve Stout. We got to get him off. We got to get him off the show. Sure.
Absolutely.
All right, so now we're going to the next segment. We're going to talk about business. If anybody's a loyal listener, our first episodes, like the first six episodes each, we had a segment called Story Time where we were like breaking down business deals and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't done that in a while because we had guests. And guests, it's kind of hard to do that. But we're not going to do a story time, but we're going to keep in line with our original premise of how we used to do the show and kind of break down deals and talk about different stuff, but we're going to do it from a unique perspective. So, once again, Diddy, a legend, a business legend, hip hop legend, all of that stuff, right? So, you worked with Diddy firsthand for years, right? So, you know just as good as anybody knows him, especially when it comes to business. So, on the financial side, we're going to talk about a couple of deals that he made, but can you just talk about his business philosophy and how he's been able to leverage his star power and things of that nature?
Absolutely. Sean Combs is a great entrepreneur. He is, I will go down in history, as one of the greatest entrepreneurs in American history from my standpoint. Mm-hmm. And he's a great entrepreneur. First, a lot of people don't know, he started as a businessman. He, you know, people know him as an artist and a fashion icon and so on and so forth, but his first role in the entertainment business was as an owner, you know, first as an A&R, you know, at Uptown Records, but then, you know, ultimately as an owner of Bad Boy Records. He was not an artist when he first owned Bad Boy Records. So from there, from, you know, where he took that company alone as a as an entrepreneur was incredible and would go down in the history in and of itself. But then to, one of the things I say I was really super fortunate to experience, and this is something that, you know, is part of the American dream experience, is to see businesses go from an idea, from like sketches on the table, to like a real business with hundreds of employees, with hundreds of million dollars in sales, and like not just once. Like I started like three, four times over. Literally like things being sketched out. We're gonna do this, how the clothes are gonna look, what's the TV network gonna look like, you know, how what are the segments we want, you know, on a 24-hour day, what's that gonna look like? Going from that, you know, from an idea to actually happening. And that's a phenomenal, incredible thing, really difficult to do. And to do it, you know, three or four times over in a big way like, you know, Sean Combs did is really unprecedented. And
when I told him, it's like, a huge time frame. We're talking like 20 years. He's done this four times.
Absolutely. He's still got more to come, too, right? Yeah. So this is these are the years where most executives are really just getting in the groove and creating great ideas. I will say, he is rarefied air as an entrepreneur. So you have to understand that first. So it's not by accident. It's not, you know, luck. It's, you know, he has great instincts. He has great instincts. He has great negotiating instincts. He has great instincts of the marketplace, right? So essentially what Puff purposefully created was a whole new category, which, you know, I call and we call urban aspiration. That category really didn't exist, right? So, and off of that category, if you really think about everything he created, so it started with the music, mm-hmm. and everybody would talk about the shiny suits, this, that, and the other, but he showed you lifestyle that no one ever thought about it, other than in a comedic way, showing, you know, for the hip-hop community. He showed you private jet, mm-hmm. lifestyle, jet ski lifestyle, mm-hmm. and it all was purposeful about this narrative around, you know, we can aspire to these great things. Sean John was totally about aspiration. It was like, I want clothes that feel like you're rich, that you're wearing. I want, you know, at this time he had felt, you know, Gucci and all these other brand names on him. And he's like, I want Sean John to feel like that on the consumer. And I wanted to fit them right, and they're going to feel like, you know, $1 million when they put it on. So he created a whole category, once again, just a rare thing for anybody to do. And he parlayed that category into different consumer products, from clothing to then spirits, you know, to even how he approached his television work and many other different consumer products categories that he got involved in, including water and other things. So
aqua hydrate.
Aqua hydrate. Yeah. So that's right. We're on camera, so you can see it. Yeah, so that, so, but a couple of things I would say, this is really, I think, unique about someone like myself working with him. I'm there to be the analytical person and to do everything I learned, right? It's like do valuation models. And for all of my fellow MBAs and so on, like when you get around someone like a Sean Combs or Sean Carter or whatever, don't think you have to lose the skill set that you're supposed to be bringing to the table. In fact, trust that skill set because it's really important, and it's important for you to bring that to the table. But I would say what I learned is that there is something important about instinct, there is something important about celebrity, and there is something important about, you know, knowing your value and being able to walk away from it. So I'd say one of the great things that Sean was able to always do in almost any deal I was involved in him with is I would set the range and say, okay, we're going to the room. If we get this deal to around this level, you know, if we get it to like $15 million, that's a really good deal. We really should do it,
right?
If it's below that, we can, you know, maybe we want to keep negotiating, you know, whatever. So many a times I've been in the room and we get to the 15, and I'm like, I'm smiling, I'm happy, like smiling on the inside. And he's, and you know, and he's just he'll look at him like, yeah, all right, well, I don't think we're going to have a deal today. You know, y'all just don't really know my value. Thanks very much. I'll talk to you later. And I'm like kicking him, like, what are you doing? We got to our number, you know what I mean? But he was like, I could look in their eyes and know they wanted to do more. You know what I mean? I know they're not leaving here without doing this deal. But, like I said, everyone's an entrepreneur. That takes guts. To walk away from some of the numbers we would walk away from and say no to, that he would walk away from and say no to, takes a lot of guts and belief in yourself. And that was part of how he approached deals. He never went into a deal like, I gotta have this deal. He never went into anything with desperation. And some of that is about planning. So anything you saw Sean Combs and Bad Boy do, it had been in the works for years. I wasn't involved in anything that didn't take 12 to 24 months. It had been in the works for years. So none of these are like knee-jerk. Like, one of the better places to be as an athlete or an entertainer is where you have to make decisions to survive, right? Survival decisions versus you've mapped out a course. Like, you know, Sean was very strategic about, when am I going to be in the spirits business? I know I'm going to be there at a certain point, but I want to build my brand of celebration. I want to build my brand of aspiration enough so that when I get to the spirits business, I can create a brand that sits at a certain price point, that stands for a certain thing, and that will be presented the right way. So these things were orchestrated, you know, years in advance before we got into the businesses. And then negotiating the deals, to negotiate the deal you really want sometimes takes a long time and means you're going to have a lot of patience, a lot of faith in yourself. People are going to come to you many times to say, all right, do this deal now or we're walking away. And you may have to say, all right, walk away.
Not the worst.
Right. And I mean, that was him. He was great at that, but also great at just identifying opportunities. We talked about it earlier, identifying white space. Mm. In the spirits industry, that the success of Ciroc was all about identifying the white space. There was no premium alcohol that our community could call their own. They were like running to the Grey Gooses, all these other brands that really didn't want us as customers. Mm-hmm. And he knew there was a huge white space.
So how did the Ciroc deal even come about? Right? Because at that time, we saw a lot of people, well, mostly, yeah, I felt like Bad Boy and Rock and Roll were both, right? They had Rock and Ridge, that was like our favorite color, man. Like, we were on that Fifth Ave store all the time, right? But, you know, they were coming out with Armadale, and I remember Ludacris had came out with alcohol, and was the idea to create your own or partner with a company that was already existing? How did that deal come about?
So the deal was with Diageo, and they had done a couple of things with Bad Boy and Sean, and just loved the results. So I think, I'm not sure what the long list of things were, but whether they were events, parties, everything they did, you know, Puff just over-delivered to, you know, in a way that they were like, we really want to be in business. Mm-hmm. So honestly, the initial conversations were a range of things. You know, we start our own product, develop something from scratch, and biggest thing that happened was they had this product, this product that they said, you know, look, we just launched this, and I really haven't done much. You know, what do you think about it? And he thought it worked for him. So we ended up going down that path. And that was the first product. The next product was he always did want to create something from scratch. And the next product was the tequila product that we owned, which was an acquisition, but again, was totally driven by something he wanted to do and something he had vetted out and wanted to launch.
When I read like the history of like Ciroc, names like Nick Storm come up, and I know he was part of the Hypnotic movement.
Yes.
And then was he part of the team originally that was the acquisition part with Ciroc?
Yeah, he was in day one at the acquisition level, but I think immediately, you know, he was on that list of people we need like day two to go, you know, promote the brand.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that another thing, and I'm not going to give away all the secrets because I know the book is coming. The book is coming. The book is coming for sure. But another thing, you know, Sean was always focused on was not playing fair. So how do I use my celebrity to catapult something in a unique way? How do I do things that other people can't do to catapult my brands uniquely? And that was the approach with Ciroc, is that I have to really own the lifestyle. And I'm going to do it, you know, unfairly. I'm going to go get every celebrity friend I have, but not only that, but every lifestyle person in each market. You know, who's the person on the radio? Who's the receptionist that just knows everybody? Who are the party throwers in each market? I'm going to go lock all of them down, create ambassadors, create, you know, the Ciroc DJs, you know, create Ciroc girls. How am I going to lock down the lifestyle?
It's like they turned from the 90s era of making $1 million video to the 60-cent commercial that feels like $1 million video. So he's in a helicopter. He's like James Bond, like Shaggy likes to call him Black Caesar. Like, well, most of these commercials are like, yeah, if we drink Ciroc, we can have that lifestyle too. So like, yeah, he's a genius.
Yeah, shout out to Diddy, man. That's why I call him Black Caesar. he just embodies that whole vibe. So, all right, so. Okay, Revolt TV, right? That's a groundbreaking, revolutionary, and you ran Revolt, right? You CEO, Chief Operating Officer, you were the head of Revolt, right? So, what were the challenges of that? Because that's different from the music business as far as going into, you know, having a network, like, because you were there from the start of Revolt.
Yeah.
So, can you talk about Revolt?
Yeah, so Revolt, and just to be clear, I was COO, the CEO, at the time, was someone who, my good friend and I talked about from Urban Profile, Keith Cleanscale. When he left for a small period, I was like, you know, the highest ranking executive, but eventually the CEO did join. So, but I was involved from the beginning, and I've been on the board since the beginning of the world. I'm still on the board, actually. So the real opposite, so I go back a couple of years. This is, some people know this part of the story, but I don't know if everyone knows. But so Sean was having incredible success producing shows for MTV and VH1.
Making a band and all that.
He was the highest earning producer of television for MTV at one point. He had multiple Making a Bands going on. I mean, that was like one of the longest running series going from Danity Kane, well, going way back to the band with, you know.
Day 26.
That was a good album. Danity Kane. Yeah. But so anyway, so he had his run there, which was phenomenal. He had his run on VH1, had a comedy specials on HBO. So he's making all this content. He was just like, man, if they're writing these kind of checks to me, how much money are they making? Right? Yeah. So the original idea was about this group coming together and doing like a mega challenge no one's ever seen. After the crash, you know, everyone kind of went their own ways, and we just kept really, you know, watching the cable marketplace. And despite the fact that it's a declining distribution vehicle, there were going to be only a few remaining opportunities to get that footprint. One of them was through Comcast,
charm was always about use this distribution. The beauty of cable or the cable business is that you earn what they call affiliate fees. So you get paid a per household fee to put your content up in certain markets. So if we're in, you know, whatever, if we're in 20 million households, you negotiate a rate per household, let's say it's 10 cents per household per month, right? That means if I'm in 20 million households, I'm making $2 million a month for that distribution, which is great. It's an annuity. I'm getting that every month. As long as the subscribers stay at that level, I'm going to make that every month. So it's a great economic model, which is, you know, a lot of people built huge fortunes on, like MTV, Viacom, MTV, VH1, like in their heydays when
CBS,
you know,
say again? CBS as well.
CBS, CBS owns, you know, Viacom, but and so the cable, this cable distribution, and CBS is a network. So they have some cable networks, but they also have their network business as well, which is a different model. But this model, you know, of earning affiliate fees and getting distribution is just a great model to launch a channel. But knowing where the world was going, the idea was to use this distribution to really build a brand that then you could take to multi-platforms. Take, you know, through digital, mobile, and really have a brand that became meaningful across platforms. And that when we really launched Revolt, we were at the beginning of that. Like, we were probably, we used to say we were the first cable network that really started promoting the channel on social media before the channel was launched.
Yeah.
Because it was that new of an idea that you could drive people to cable through social media and so on. So that's the era we were in. And literally, Revolt has seen this change from cable distribution to digital distribution, has seen that change happen in front of its eyes, and really modeled its business around how do you get out in front of that change and make sure you're relevant in the global platforms.
So, so as far as the TV, like you said, TV is kind of dying right now, right? So the Volta and the TV space, man, I see they're doing different things and they're trying different stuff. What's the future of that as far as it's concerned? Not just for Volta, but TV stations in general, but how is that transition look as far as talking TV to the internet? So how does that look like for?
Yeah, one of the things, again, I go back to my conversation about big data and some of the technology companies that have been driving. The other thing that they created with these algorithms is they became a blockade to your content. If you're, you know, if you're a cable network or if you're a television network and you just want to have other ways to display your content to your viewers, you could again build up massive followings, and then, you know, Facebook, you know, at one point would the algorithm would show the content to less people if you were linking video content from your website versus if you were originally putting digital content directly into Facebook.
So they don't want you to promote yourself.
They don't want you to promote, and they don't want you to promote anyone going outside of Facebook. So if I put up the same piece of content that was linked to my website because I really want to ultimately get people to click back to my website versus directly linked to Facebook, I'm going to get 1/10 the initial views just based on the algorithm. So they began really, they have been and do now, they've now entered into this space in terms of being a real, being something you have to really navigate in order to make sure you're getting your content out to your consumers. So I go back to, if you think about the future, it goes back to where technology is going. We have to be able to hit our viewers and customers and followers directly. So I do see in the future, there's going to be, and you see Disney doing it with the direct distribution of its content to direct to consumers. HBO Go,
going to happen is you're going to have strong, strong brands that people are going to want directly. And I think as time goes on, the most important thing for a brand like Revolt or any brand that, you know, was developed in the last 10, 15 years is to be important enough to your viewers that when you want to try to go to them directly with content, that they're going to respond.
All right, so one of the things we said earlier is that we know each other for some years, and we met at church. Obviously, you're a man of God, a man of God as well. And one of the things that you were doing at church was a homeless outreach called Isaiah's Home. And through that, we were able to feed people in need and hold people in need. And I actually took a summer group there last summer, and it was just a fulfilling time. The kids really loved it. And they took some from it to a point where they wanted to come back and do it again. And you were at Revolt, and obviously with Bad Boy, but you left. And one of the things that was honorable is that you said that your life and your career weren't matching. Right? Like your purpose didn't match your career. And so you left and you became the CEO of Robinhood. You want to talk about what Robinhood is?
Sure.
And,
yeah, so Robinhood is a 30-year-old New York-based foundation that basically supports poverty fighting programs with the goal of moving and lifting families out of poverty sustainably. We do it with all vehicles, right? So affordable housing, education, job training, feeding people if that's what they need, connecting them to benefits if that's what's going to help lift them or sustain them. So we use, you know, early childhood development programs, health programs. So across the spectrum, Robinhood deploys over $100 million a year. And basically we're a fund of funds. And on some occasions also the creator of programs if we're not finding a program out there that meets the need that we think is really valuable for the community. But, you know, so we receive every year from our generous donors about, you know, more than $100 million because they also support the overhead of the company. But then we then take that money and use financial principles. So all of the origination of Robinhood really comes from some really successful hedge fund owners who, during a time of financial collapse, or during that same financial collapse, they were, you know, thinking about their own businesses and saying, wow, we're hurting. The least of these must be hurting even more. We need to do something to help, and they created Robinhood. But the principles of Robinhood are really based on a very financial-oriented principle of how do we screen people doing the best work, and really funding everyone based on the benefit-cost ratio. And really measuring how much benefit are we getting out of this dollar that we're investing in these various organizations, and screening out those organizations based on how well they're performing, and then measuring them rigorously quarter by quarter to make sure they're meeting their goals. So that's an overview of Robinhood. I'm a native New Yorker, as I said earlier, from the Bronx, so it's near and dear to my heart to be doing work in New York. And also very much believe that, you know, my faith informs me that, you know, a lot of people struggle with looking at this world and saying, well, for those of you who believe in God, where is God? Like, so much going on. You got this going on in the White House. You got this going on in these countries. You got people shooting up people. Where is God? And, you know, what I've learned is that, you know, God is where people in need are, right?
Yes, it is.
And if you show up and amidst those people, you'll have an experience with God. You'll meet God. One of the things I'll say about being at Robinhood is that, you know, I've been there now 18 months, and I can just say every single issue that you know is an issue is worse than you thought it was, especially for our communities of color. It's worse than you thought it was. It's daunting, honestly, and it's cold bread. It's urgent.
So where do we start with that? Because I had a client, friend of mine. He's from anyway, he was telling me, we were having lunch one day, and he was telling me that he was saying how Africa gives so much money. Every country gives so much money to charity. Said as far as the, it's just discouraging on a lot of different levels as far as like education and homelessness and all kinds of different stuff that's rampant in every neighborhood all across the world. So how do we fix these problems? Because, I mean, we can continue to just give money, but there has to be something deeper than that. Like, what's the, is it education? I'm a big proponent of education. We don't talk about education. But what's the underlying solution? Not that you have all the answers.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Honestly, it's one I ask myself every day because it's a bunch of things. Right? We have to really look at historically how we ended up where we are. Historically also, you can say, as daunting as the task looks now, there has been a lot of improvement, which is actually pretty amazing, but there's still a lot of things that need to get done. I would say, you know, one of the clear things is that you cannot look at this problem and not try to understand the systemic issues, right? And that's what goes back to policy, goes back to really unraveling what's going on. So I believe, as you do, and the data bears out, that one of the, there's like kind of must-haves, and then there's a bunch of other stuff. The must-haves are education. Must-haves. If you're not on grade level by the third, there's plenty of data that shows if you're not on reading level by the third grade, you're not likely to graduate high school, you have an increased likelihood of living a life of poverty. Just straight up facts, right? So, we have done so much work, and we have a great group of people that spend their days just thinking about early childhood brain development. Some of this stuff is so sophisticated, and I love the work we're doing, that how do you take really a child from the womb and really start developing their brain so they're equipped and ready to go be successful in this academic environment and ultimately graduate high school and then graduate college, because that's where you get to true mobility, is where you get to, at a minimum high school, but in most cases you need college as well to get there. So, we have a lot of work to be done in the education space. So one of the things I did before I left working for Sean Combs was I worked with him when he founded a charter school network in New York City, a Capital Prep. He recruited, again, his approach is always go find the best, and he recruited Dr. Steve Perry to run his schools, and we launched the first school, Capital Prep Harlem, which is now finishing its third year, and we're about to launch Capital Prep Bronx in 2020.
Okay.
Yeah, so we got awarded the charter for another school in the Bronx, and there's possibly a third one on the way, and they already have schools in several schools in Bridgeport, Connecticut as well.
That's where Dr. Perry, he's from Connecticut, right?
He's from Connecticut, so his first school was actually in Hartford.
Right. I remember watching specials on him, and I'm like, wow, this guy's amazing. His intellectual, his brain power, his ideas. I mean, he was waking up at 4:30. They documented him on CNN. He had a series.
Yeah.
And then when I saw that he was part of Capital Prep, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
I remember I saw you in church, and you were like, what are you thinking about coming to Capital Prep?
Exactly.
And I just...
We're still working on
it. I just left the city to come to do a show.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I'm thinking about it. But I'm happy to see that it's doing well in the Bronx. That's dope, man.
Yeah, that's going to be great. Really excited about it. But, here's what we face. Being there has been, and I'm chairman of the board, being there has been, I've learned so much, so quickly, and I learned the challenge I have in front of me. So we get a random pool. One of the things people always wonder about charter schools is, are you kind of getting self-selected students? But we get a random pool of students from the city. And on average, the students, so we start in the sixth grade and go through the 12th grade.
Mm-hmm.
So on average, the kids that we're getting, they're generally coming from other district schools in the city,
other charter schools. They're two to three grade levels behind in English, and 3 to 4 grade levels behind, sometimes even 5 grade levels behind in math. We had the last two classes of sixth graders we brought in to Capital Prep, 0 of the students came in proficient in math. So this is what is going on in the public schools in New York City, right? Yeah. So how do you get to the sixth grade and have kids that are so far off of grade level? So what Capital Prep does, and just to really understand the magnitude of what Dr. Perry has done, every school he's had, every graduate of his, every high school graduate of his schools has gone to a four-year college. So that's, I mean, there's, and honestly, there's no way, you know, that's like an impossible task as you look at the world today. But that's, his, when you show up, it's basically all about, do you want to go to a four-year college? Because if you don't, this may not be the place for you. We're going to work you and put you through a longer school year, longer days, longer school year, Saturdays. 50% of the students from Capital Prep do like a full day of school on Saturday because they got to catch up.
Yeah.
There's only one way. You can have some magical teaching approaches and this, that, and the other. There's only one way to really catch up, which is more time. So if I have to catch you up 2-3 grade levels, I need you for more time to catch you up. But the idea that we're getting a random sample and this is what it looks like says to me, like, what does the full population really look like? And we know that if those kids don't graduate high school, they're done.
Yeah.
And if you add on top of that, not graduating high school, any interaction with the criminal justice system, which has a whole ton of systemic issues, especially against black and brown peoples, and on their early being a parent under 21, you're like, there's those three factors, if all three of them are in place, highly likely that you'll live with black and brown.
I want to question something, because, like you said, we know each other for years, but you've been a role model just by your presence, right? Like, we haven't had many conversations, but we have dialogue. And to watch you be a man of God, to be in touch with culture, right? Like, I could, you know, Louis Wilson. Like, I doubt there's many men your age that know Louis Wilson. So, be in touch with culture and be a family man. To watch that, it's admirable. So, thank you for being a role model to me. I'm sure many of you.
Sure, sure. So, couple of housekeeping items. So the first is that this is exclusive news. But by the time you hear it, it won't be. we was in LA and we did a networking event in LA and that was crazy. So we plan on doing this we had to come home. So we are doing a networking mixer meet and greet on the 13th of June, June 13th. Out, meet us. We're going to have a lot of the guests that we had on the show.
That's all the invite. All alumni are welcome.
It's going to be dope. It's going to be a chance to meet all our guests that we've had, meet us, and then most importantly, meet each other. That's the great part about LA. It's like when everybody was just meeting each other and talking, networking, and it was just a real inspiring moment to just see people just come together and that had never met, but they lived in the same city.
Right.
And then they got a chance to brainstorm. You never know who you might meet. You might meet somebody that could be a business partner. You might meet somebody that, you can make a lot of money with, you can help out, you can change the world with. So that's what we want to do. So New York is up. Brooklyn specifically, because we got a lot of love in Brooklyn. That's the biggest one. So
yeah.
We're doing that. So we're gearing up for that. Once again, June 13th, and then after that, Atlanta. We got to hit Atlanta, but we do one thing at a time. So New York, we're excited about that. And also, Troy, you want to talk about
Patreon? So our Patreon is moving, it's growing. We took your what you were saying. We got your feedback, and one of the things we were saying to one of our members, Tiana, is we're not going to hoard the content anymore. So now there's no bonus clips anymore. We're putting out the full unedited episodes on Patreon. So thank you for everybody who's been supporting that. It's patreon.com/earnleisure. We have 5 different tiers. You can join at any tier you'd like. Obviously, each tier has different
things that are offered. But we got some new Patreon members I want to shout out. Tony, Vicky, Samaya, and OG. And, you know, our faithful is Terry and Cody, shout out to y'all. But, yeah, Patreon's moving. Keep supporting that so we can keep doing things and going and traveling throughout the country, giving the word about financial literacy. And our merch is up. We got, you know, the new merch is on RainyVision.com. Feel free to support that. You know, we got some new slogans. We got our Hometown Hero series. We're going to announce what the premise of that campaign is probably after our New York event. We're going to announce what the Hometown Hero series is. And, yeah, man, keep supporting. Thank you.
Yeah, and also YouTube. So if you remember the Brandon Copeland interview, we chopped that up and we put some bonus content. We know that, you know, we don't want to run too long on the podcast. So when we have good content, we take the parts that we're not going to use for the podcast, and we're going to put that only on YouTube. It's the only place you're going to see that is on YouTube. So subscribe to our YouTube channel because we are going to be releasing exclusive content only for YouTube on there. And then we're also going to start doing how-to videos. I'm actually going to start doing some videos too. So it's going to be dope. Like how-to. I know we've been saying that for a while, but YouTube is up and running. So make sure you subscribe to our YouTube. That's extremely important.
Comment and like.
Yeah, for sure. And book tip of the week. My book tip of this week is Charlemagne the God's book, Black Privilege. I thought it was a really good book. I always was a fan of his, but after the book, I had a newfound appreciation for him. So it's dope. It kind of tells his life story and talks about his journey from South Carolina to New York on the radio and all kinds of stuff. So highly recommend that book for anybody. You know, it's not just for one particular purpose, but it's just a good book in general. So yes, that is the book tip of the week, and we'll see you guys next week.
Peace.